Hi, I'm Yoni Mazur, the Chief Growth Officer of Getida, the global leader in Amazon FBA auditing and reimbursement solutions for Amazon sellers worldwide. FBA sellers can experience discrepancies with their inventory. It could get lost, damaged, destroyed, or get overcharged with fees. These discrepancies can total up to 3% of an annual revenue of an Amazon seller. So if you're making $1 million in annual revenue on FBA, you may have up to $30,000 to recover each year. Getida will help you get the maximum FBA reimbursements you're eligible for. Our technology audits your FBA transactions daily for discrepancies, and our claims specialists manage your FBA cases until resolutions. Signing up for Getida is free. Let's get to work and see how much money we can recover for you.
Support the show sponsor and receive $400 in free FBA reimbursements by visiting getida.com/ptexpod. That's getida.com/ptexpod.
In fact, you're going to hear me say three things quite often. That's heard, understood, and appreciated. People will crawl through the desert, bypass the water, and spend their last time just to feel heard, understood, and appreciated. To be connected, to be accepted, to be a part of a group, those are basic hungers that we all have.
Welcome to the Let's Talk Business podcast. Gain valuable and actionable tools from the world's top business leaders to help you grow, lead, and succeed. Here's your host, Manny Hoffman.
Coming to you from the PTX headquarters in Brooklyn, New York, this is the podcast for no-nonsense advice to help you learn, grow, and lead. Today, I'm so excited to welcome our guest, Keith Hatrell. Keith has been an avid student of human behavior and human thought processes his entire life. A certified coach, a certified master hypnosis, he has entertained and enlightened thousands of audiences around the world using world-class ventriloquism, magic, hypnosis, and humor to transform teams for the better in fun and disarming ways. Let me ask you, when we each live in our own private world, surrounded by so many boundaries, how can we learn to reach out to achieve effective communication? This is such an important question because communication is key to so many things around us. This and so much more is in our interview. Let's get right to our conversation with Keith Hatrell. Keith, thank you so much for joining me on the Let's Talk Business podcast.
Thank you. I enjoy being here. Thank you very much.
You know how things go so fast. So we relatively got to know each other pretty recently, where one of our clients were looking for a speaker in an event they did in Florida, and you were able to fly down in pretty short notice.
Very short notice, yes.
And that was a great presentation over there based on the feedback. And we figured then, you know, the next step is getting you on the podcast. So here we are. So
all right.
There's a lot to uncover. We, you know, our listeners know that, you know, we have certain themes within the podcast and different types of experts we bring on the show. Of course, we always bring business owners as well. But you have a combination, entertainer, expert, performing. And I think you have performed on stage as early as 4 year old. So I know we're going to get to the meat and the potatoes and how that actually applies to leaders and people and so on and so forth. Give us a little bit of your backstory, how you got to where you are today.
Gosh, okay. I'll try to do that in 90 minutes or less. On the entertainment side, my dad was a band director for schools in Dearborn, Michigan, but he was a real vaudevillian ham on the side. And so he had me in front of audiences, like you said, since I was about 4 years old. I remember when I was four, I sang this little solo in front of a church full of people. My whole family was up front. And then my dad started giving me singing lessons when I was seven. And I tried to tell him, Daddy, I already know how to sing. And he says, yeah, but you relied on cuteness then. You're not going to be cute forever. So we need to do this. But anyway, I grew up entertaining church talent shows, all kinds of stuff, really. And when I got to college, I put together a birthday party show with magic juggling and balloon animals and put classified ads around Ann Arbor and made 50 whole dollars for birthday party back then. And so that side of it just kind of grew from there. And I just kept always, the name of my company at first was Excelsior Entertainment, because I always believed in ever Excelsior, always growing, getting better and better. On the mindset, the human behavior side, I was the, how can I say this quickly? We were a not so blended family where I was the mistake that happened 4 years after my parents got married, and my older half siblings, none of them wanted this wedding, right? So I found myself in this unique circumstance to kind of grow up observing much older siblings and the dynamics within the family. And I just was a natural observer of it. And it fit in with performing, because when you perform and you pay your dues and you step into all these different subcultures, it's like you're an outside observer to the world. So it always, human behavior always fascinated me. And I had my own challenges in being that odd one out in my family that I had to really try to understand. So when I started dabbling in the hypnosis, originally it was just to add a new show to my playlist, but I really drank the Kool-Aid. And that's when I really achieved the expertise that I have now on human dynamics and how our subconscious minds work, what makes us all tick. And that led to the NLP certifications and all that stuff. So in a nutshell, that's where I come from.
So I want to get to, this is an interesting dynamic because ultimately your approach on stage obviously has a mixture of the fun elements, the content elements, and everything that comes alongside it. Today, I want to focus on the conversation is all about people. So the human elements of things and what you've learned, A, with the expertise and studying it, but more importantly, now that you're speaking in front of larger audiences and companies and so on and so forth. You know, there's something that you have said that, you know, businesses aren't buildings or products or services. They are people connecting with people. Another similar line I heard on the show from one of our guests in the past was, once upon a time, you met people at a networking event. You asked them, what do you do? I'm the service business. I'm the product business. And that's how you explained what you do as a starting the conversation. Now we're all in the people business, regardless how the transaction happens. But it's in the people business, especially in the last couple of years where culture and internal and hiring became such a huge, important aspect of businesses. For the most part, for people that are looking to hire or overhiring, whatever it is, finding out, even if you have to do a layoff, like which people to let go, which people to keep. So I guess my question to you, tell me more about the human nature, you know, what makes up a person and a person that you want to be around versus the people that you want to stay away with.
Okay, well, hopefully you can learn to connect with everyone that you have to be connected with, even if you don't want to be. Where to begin? You're right. Even now, I can imagine some listeners out there thinking, well, my entire business is click and serve, right? We're in an economy where a cheaper price, a better package, quicker shipping is two clicks away. Even with all of that, business is about humans interacting with humans. And when a company calls me, they'll say, we want you to do something on leadership. We want you to do something on influence or DEI or conflict resolution or communication, sales effectiveness. Do you have a program on that? And my answer is always yes, because it really is, from my point of view, it's all about human dynamics in the workplace, humans interacting with humans. And the better you can connect with other humans, the better you can do in your career and in your business. And when you think about that, it's not just frontline employees pleasing customers. You're working with vendors, and those vendors may be in a position where they can make or break your delivery dates. They can be with coworkers. You have to share a cubicle or an office with somebody, or you've got someone who is competing for the next promotion. It could be people that report to you or people that you report to. All of these are human-to-human connections. And I think, many, you touched on this a little bit. One thing we learned the hard way from the pandemic was this mass exodus. People just did not want to come back to work. And I think the lesson learned, I don't know how they're making a living now. I don't know, you know, maybe we don't want to know. But I think the lesson learned there was they realized, okay, I'm tired of trading my life for dollars. The money doesn't mean as much as fulfillment, as a sense of belonging, as a sense of being a part of something bigger than myself, being appreciated, being connected, just being part of a mission. You know, every company has a mission statement, but they get stuck in a book, or there may be a plaque on the wall that becomes part of the landscape. And we forget what that mission statement is. And quite often, the mission statement really doesn't mean that much to most of the people there. So it's so much more than that. It's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of fulfillment. It's a sense of job satisfaction. And so going back to what I was saying about, I'll say yes to pretty much anything. I mean, if I feel I can talk on it, of course, I'm not going to say yes to absolutely anything. But if it's anything involving the human dynamics, then I know, okay, yeah, I'm going to change stories. I'm going to change buzzwords and I'm going to change takeaways based on whether they ask for leadership or influence or whatever. But in my area of expertise, because I am an expert at the root level, where all humans are the same, regardless of race, creed, color, all of that stuff, I can talk to any of these things because we are interacting person to person. Well, go ahead.
So let me just ask you, because this is an important, because this reminds me of the point, like a lot of times I'll speak to a business owner or I'll be at an event and I'll hear the line, like, my business is different. You know, when you hear a speaker speaking or something along those lines and say, you know what? Yeah, he spoke good, but my business is different. And I always say, right. You know what? Your business isn't different. The application might be different. The business isn't different. So I want to zoom in a little bit. I think we have not covered that enough on the podcast, which is the human element of things, which means is, and I want to go back to the example you gave, because this is something actually, it's still bothering me. So you saw the pandemic. Obviously, there was a time period where people couldn't work in offices. So they started working remotely. But then came the time that people started to have to almost like force people to get back to the office. Now, I could understand if it's a toxic environment or if there's a ton of traveling involved and everything like that. I could understand that that's where you're saying I'm making a calculated decision. I'm losing 5 hours of my day just by traveling, or 2 hours, whatever it is.
Right.
But let's take the other example, which is maybe only 50 minutes away from the office, but your office gives you that communication, being face to face with your coworkers, talking about a company maybe that has a good culture. Why do people, some people, not realize and recognize what that does for humanity? That part of being around like-minded individuals, learning from each other versus being alienated in front of a screen, you know, in a coffee shop, whatever it is.
Yeah, I'll tell you that you worded that question very well. I think culture deprives us of that understanding. If you look back, cases of depression and anxiety have increased exponentially since the end of World War II. And the theory behind that is that technology is outpacing sociology, our ability to socialize with each other. So now when we're in this realm, this chaos of connection, and I'm using air quotes when I say connection, we can connect over all the social media platforms. We can text each other. We can email each other, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not connecting and we don't feel that energy. And I don't think people realize that. I think because we are locked into this model of thinking we're connected because we're connecting over Zoom and all of that stuff, we tend to underappreciate what it means to be in the same room with someone else. There was the name's going to escape me now, but a famous study where only 7% of communication is the actual words you use. Everything else is all about body language and tone of voice. So when you're texting each other or you're emailing or you're posting on social media, there's a 93% chance that that meaning is going to be lost or there's going to be a miscommunication or a misunderstanding. And I think it frustrates me because you're right. I've talked to companies where they say, we cannot get the workforce to come back to the office. And I really think it's because, like I've just said, the culture approves of this isolation. It encourages this isolation. And what's dangerous about it, I can only believe that the pendulum is going to swing back. I really feel that way because I think people are going to realize they're hungry to be back together. You know, there are workplace conflicts and there's that person you can't stand at work and you don't want to have to deal with your boss, et cetera, et cetera. You don't feel like someone's looking over your shoulder. You know, there's all the cliche work issues, and it just feels like it's easier to avoid them than to learn how to work within them. And until we can have some great change in the cultural influence, that's always going to be a challenge. And that's why I go back when I talk about leadership, I talk about painting people into a picture. You mentioned earlier, a lot of business owners think, oh, it was a great speech, but it doesn't apply to my business. And I think that tells me that the speaker didn't paint that particular person into the concept, into the picture. When I do a hypnosis show or keynote presentation, I learned early on that if I say, okay, you're hot, you're feeling hotter, you're feeling hotter, your body temperature is going up, you're starting to bead with sweat, etc., that may get one or two people that I have on stage. But if I say, okay, you're on a beach lounger in Jamaica, and right now it's perfect, but the sun is rising, it's getting hotter and hotter. You feel the breeze, you can hear the waves, you paint them into that picture, right? So it's the same thing with business. If you can paint people into why we're all together and how the synergy happens and how when you're in a conference room together, there is a certain energy that maybe people don't believe in. They don't believe that this energy exists, but it's there and it's palpable. I'll tell you, I was at a workshop. This was years ago. This is when I was first starting out. This was the mid-90s. And we emptied a conference room. There were three or four chairs placed around the conference room, and there were about 30 of us, and we were all blindfolded. And our job was to walk around the room, but do it slowly, without making a sound. Do it slowly so that you don't bump into anyone. And I used to have a video of this. I don't know where it is. It's on a VHS tape somewhere. But it was fascinating because we would bump into the chair because the chair has no memory, it has no energy. But we never bumped into each other. When you walk slowly, you can feel that energy bubble there. And it made, up until that point, I thought it was mysticism until I did that experiment. And I was blown away by that. That was life-changing for me because it really did matter. And then you start to feel, wow, I really connect with this person. And you've felt this, many. When you really connect with someone and you get into a conversation that you both just get all this energy, right? You want to keep talking forever and you suddenly forget how tired you are, or you forget your to-do list because you're really connecting. That is so hard to do through a screen, right?
Sure.
So I wish I had a better answer for that, but it's really about teaching people to appreciate all the good that comes from being in the same room together.
That's a great start. I want to get even deeper to understand the human nature on the sense of, what does, like you mentioned before, the word that you think at one point people will have the hunger to go back and be in front of other people. So that statement is a bold statement. Have the hunger of that, which means is the body, the human element of it needs that for survival.
Yes.
Where would you say, where are we currently missing? Where you feel with social media and everything that goes around it, that you feel that at one point we'll develop that hunger that's missing in our lives. And we want to be back in person meetings.
I think time will tell. When you ask the question that way, it reminded me of one of our primeval experiences. We are, anthropologically speaking, we are tribal animals. And if you were ostracized from the tribe, that was typically a slow, suffering, painful death for the individual because it was so much more difficult, you know, in the days of mastodons and saber-toothed tigers, whatever. It was so much more difficult to survive as a human being, as an individual, as opposed to a group. The other thing about that is that there was a natural desire to meet people from other tribes. And the reason they think that's true is because if you were just mating within the tribe, then you have inbreed and then the tribe fails to survive, right? So this mm-hmm. is very primeval, anthropological, caveman kind of speaking. But those instincts are still there. And I think that I just have to say that if people give it a chance to start socializing again, they'll start to realize how much they've missed it. Certainly there was a hunger to socialize, but there was an avoidance to get back to work. That tells us that there are some real problems with how people feel they're being heard, understood, and connected with at work, right? It's one thing to be invited out with friends doing something you love to do. Yeah, we can finally do that. But the concept of coming back to work where, okay, I feel underappreciated, or I don't feel heard and understood, or I can't concentrate because Flo is in the next cubicle talking on the phone and she just keeps talking to, you know, all these different things. And we tend to think only of the negatives of being to that. So I think a big part of the communication, big part of the selling that you have to do is, what are the benefits to being mm-hmm. back to work? Being seen, you're more likely to be appreciated. You're more likely to be noticed, given more responsibility, you know, all of these things. And I'll tell you, I work with a lot of HR people and they're really scratching their heads over how to make people feel appreciated in the disconnected world.
So let's speak about leadership and communication in the company environment. So like sometimes you could see conversations between, let's call it leaders and team members, where two people will leave a room and they'll have totally different expect, like, oh, this was a great meeting, whereas the person walking out, I have no clue what my leader wanted from me. I'm doing everything that I needed to do in order to be successful. I guess that's broken communication. There's a lack of proper communication, so to speak. What would you say in leaders that obviously the challenge that we're facing a lot is there's younger leaders that weren't born leaders. They were just thrown into this. Maybe they were sole entrepreneurs and then they hired the first employee, fifth employee, 10th employee. And now they have to lead a group of people. What would you say some practical pointers as far as leading great, like working on your communication and ultimately delivering proper communication?
Okay, so that brings up one of my favorite topics.
Let's go.
That is the concept. Yeah, here we go. Here we go. I'm warmed up now. It's the concept of the model of the world. Each person has a map of reality. For example, you're in New York, right?
Yes.
So, okay. So if you were to say you had a detailed map of New York and I were to say, okay, where is Fido the dog? Well, the map doesn't show that. Okay. The map cannot possibly show all of reality. So when we build a map, a model of the world, we build it based on our belief structure, on our formative experiences. And so that creates our representation, our model of the world. So when you have different people that you said a young leader that may have had an entrepreneurial moment because they were an exceptional code writer, but have no management experience, and they're in their 20s and they're hiring someone who's in his 50s, well, they're going to have very different models of the world. The good news is that those models are built in the same exact way. They're built on belief systems. They're built on formative experiences, et cetera. But if you really start to understand another person's model of the world, you can really use it as a tool to get into their mindset, to understand who they are. There's a paradigm shift. And I'm gonna tell a story here. When the pandemic first happened, many other entertainers and speakers, all I could think of is I had an entire year of bookings wiped out in the space of a week. But my coach, and I had just hired him, I just got on board with him, just about to be, and he said something brilliant. He said, this is the best opportunity we could have asked for. We all looked at him like he was nuts, right? What are you talking about? And he said, people need us more now than ever before. So number one, he switched the paradigm because our natural tendency is to think, what do I need this person to do for me, right? What do I need my employees to do for me? What do I need my boss to do for me, et cetera? He is brilliant at what he does because he naturally thinks, who can I serve in this moment? And the second thing he did was say, I don't know how we're going to do this, but let's be a group. You know, everyone chip in $500. Let's bring in people. And that's how I have the Zoom studio that I'm sitting in now. And I was able to pivot to being able to do virtual shows and virtual speaking engagements. So the point there is, instead of thinking in terms of what I need others to do for me, how can I serve them? So if you have people walking out of a conference room and they have no idea what you need them to do, how can I serve them to help them better understand? How can I paint them into the picture? Let's see it from their point of view. A big part of connecting with people is finding those places where the model of the world overlaps. And that can be tricky at times. But once you find that, that is the foundation for your relationship. And it could be anything. I remember years ago, we had a male nanny for my daughters. And basically, the nanny just drove them from camp to camp to camp so I could get work done during the summer. But we had a young man, and we knew the family. It was a wonderful family. I had no problem trusting this young man. But the girls, yeah, they were a little, you know, they'd always had teenage girls driving them around. So we went and had lunch, and the conversation was very awkward at first until we found that we all liked the same video game. Okay, so then, boom, our models of the world meshed and rapport was born. So that's number one. So how do you understand that model of the world? It's important to effectively listen and to get into the habit of asking, what more do I need to understand to understand the disconnect here? Or what more do I need to understand before I can really serve this person? What do I need to ask that I'm not quite getting yet? We also, our models of the world, we project them into the reality around us. We project them to the people around us. Our models of the world also filter out things that we don't believe in or we don't like. So when I worked with teenagers and they said, I'll never need calculus. It's like, okay, you may never need calculus, but you do need to learn learning skills. You need to be able to learn, problem solve, so that you have more choices in your future. It's about finding that commonality. Does that make sense? Did I go kind of?
Yeah, understood.
Okay. So I'll tell you a story that really illustrates this. And I tell this story quite often, so it's not just for you, Manny. But for my sophomore year at the University of Michigan, I was supposed to room with a good friend of mine. But as happens, he didn't quite make the cut. He didn't come back for his sophomore year. So I ended up rooming blind again my sophomore year. Rooming blind means you don't know the roommate. So I get this call, and in case he's listening, I'll change the name. His name is Wally, we'll say. All right. Wally called, and he said, and this story is going to illustrate everything. It's going to come together. He called me a few weeks before the term started and said, hi, I'm Wally. I'm your roommate. And so, oh, yeah. Hi, Wally. I got the letter, too. It's nice to meet you. Thanks for calling. He says, yeah, there's something you need to know.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-oh. Right. I'm bracing myself. Okay. He says, I'm from Bloomfield Hills. Okay. I'm from Dearborn Heights. Well, it means I'm Jewish. Okay. I'm still waiting for him to say, and I barbecue babies for fun, you know, something horrible. And that was it. That was the whole point. And he was concerned because I came from a very Protestant community that it would be a problem. So his sense of identity held that he was Jewish. And his belief structure, which wraps around our sense of identity, is that, okay, it's going to be a problem or different. This guy's a Gentile and he's going to think these things about me. Well, first, so that's his model of the world. That jumps right out at me. Secondly, from my point of view, I would have never in a million years thought to say, there's something you need to know about me. I'm from Dearborn Heights. It means I'm a United Methodist. I hope that's okay.
Yeah. You know,
I never would have thought that. We had very different models of the world. So to continue with this story, I'll be honest, I didn't like Wally. I ended up not liking Wally, but it had nothing to do with him being Jewish. When we assess other people, the first thing we assess is, are they in our community? Are they in our tribe or are they in a different tribe? Well, to me, we were University of Michigan students. We lived in a dorm. We shared a broom closet. If you've ever seen a dorm room, you know what I'm talking about. And so we were the same community. But the next thing we judged them on is behavior. And he was annoying. He was just annoying. And my friends who knew him said, he's really annoying. And I said, I know, I'm trying to get along with him, but he's really annoying. It had nothing to do with his identity. It was all about his behavior, right? But
yeah,
we're all in the cafeteria. And I'm sitting there with a bunch of my friends. And a friend comes in, sets her tray down, looks at me and says, Wally is telling everyone you hate him because he's a Jew.
Really?
Which really upset me. But before I could say anything, a bunch of my friends started laughing hysterically. They're pounding the table. They're holding their stomachs. I said, what is so funny about this? And I was like, oh, yeah, you hate us all because we're Jewish. Manny, that was the first time I realized how many of my friends were Jewish. I looked around. I had a couple of friends who were Middle Eastern, you know, Arabic descent and all of this stuff. It just didn't appeal to me. You know, it wasn't a register to me. But in his model of the world, his belief structure was such that, okay, I didn't like him. He could tell that, but it was all because of the Jewish thing.
Yeah, trying to find the place like outside of their behavior.
Right, exactly. And so that we call that confirmation bias. When we believe something, we accept things that seem to give us evidence of that, and we refute things that seem to fly in the face of that. So to bring it around to the models of the world, his model of the world actually did damage to the community, to our hall within the dorm, because I could tell that there were some people I didn't know that well who stopped saying hi to me, who stopped smiling at me and stuff, because he was spreading this belief that you know, it was all about I was anti-Semitic. And even though I had so many friends, I didn't even think what their religion was. So the reason I tell that story, and I tell that story quite often, is because we teach other people how to treat us. We project our model of the world into the world. And at the same time, our model of the world can prevent us from seeing data that could really help us feel heard, understood, and appreciated. In fact, you're going to hear me say three things quite often. That's heard, understood, and appreciated. People will crawl through the desert, bypass the water, and spend their last time just to feel heard, understood, and appreciated. To be connected, to be accepted, to be a part of a group. Those are basic hungers that we all have. So I kind of threw a lot of things out at you.
Yes. So this has been great. I want to touch on one more point and try to give you a couple of minutes on that, because I think it's an important part, because it goes a little bit in connection to what we just spoke of a moment ago, which is sometimes people use excuses. So they use excuses, and therefore that becomes the reason I'm not successful is because of X, Y, Z. The reason this guy doesn't like me is because X, Y, Z. And we use this because we need to validate a reason, because I can be the problem or my future, you know, something like along those lines.
Right.
Which brings me to this whole point. A lot of times is you have somebody that has a very bad upbringing, mm-hmm. or, you know, it could be from anything in could be in school, could be in family, could be whatever. And almost they use this as an excuse for every failure in their life growing up. You know, the common story, I think somebody shared it on this podcast. You know, there was two twin brothers that grew up in a family. The father was a thief. He was sitting in jail and everything else. And then fast forward 20 years, one guy was this mega businessman in great dealings and everything else. And the other guy also, you know, arrived in jail 20 years later. And they had this interview process, and they asked both kids, what got you to where you are? And first, the one in jail said, well, this is the upbringing I had. I saw my father. This is the life he, so I just went in his ways. And 20 years later, I'm in jail. The other guy said, well, I saw my upbringing. I saw what not to do. I decided to take charge of my life, and I want to be just the opposite.
Right.
So, and that's why 20 years later. So we tend to find an excuse on our why we're not putting in the effort and why we're not taking charge of our own life, sometimes because of an excuse of what happened in the past or something that we didn't have while maybe somebody else next to me did have. How do you overcome it? I guess some practical point is how to overcome those beliefs, as you mentioned before.
In a nutshell, that's hard to say. So yeah, the twin story is brilliant. I talk about twins all the time. Where that comes from, there's two things. Number one is when things happen to us in our childhood, we interpret them as a child would. So like a formative event happened to me when I was two, when I discovered this in my own releasing of baggage that I've done. But I interpreted things as a two-year-old would. The problem is once you make that decision, that belief locks into place, and it will stay with you forever until you go under the hood and you reanalyze that belief again for the first time. Definitely, I would recommend working with someone for any self-limiting beliefs, etc. So we make those decisions. So one, the twins saw what happened to Dad, and they each made their own decision. What does this mean? What does this mean for me? What does this mean? Am I destined to go to jail? Is, you know, it's hereditary. Apple doesn't fall from the tree, far from the tree, etc. Whereas the other one is, I want to avoid this at all costs. And it really is about a momentary decision that locks into place for a long time. The other thing that we do is we don't like open loops. Business owners will recognize this. When you have your annual review with an employee and you ask them what they accomplished, they have a hard time remembering what they accomplished. It's called the Zeigarnik effect. But if you ask them what they didn't get done, they can list that easily. And it's because our minds do not like open loops. So when there is an open loop, and it's a particularly uncomfortable, emotionally painful or uncomfortable loop, we will write a story. The story does not have to be accurate. That's the big issue, is you might write a story about your mother because of what she said, or you might write a story about your boss. And the, you know, when the boss looks at me that way, I just know she disapproves of whatever, right? the boss may be holding back gas from what she had for lunch, right? But your story is that she doesn't approve of you. So that story, but what it does do is it gives you an emotional sense of closure that makes sense for you in a way that is comfortably acceptable to you. So it's not about me, right? It's not about my behavior. Going back to Wally, it's not about my behavior. It's because of my faith. And that way, it's not me. It's on him. It's on his beliefs of who I am. So it's a comfortable, it's kind of a self-defense mechanism. So you asked how to change that. There are a number of things you can do on your own. And number one is to get some 3x5 cards. And when you realize you're thinking a self-limiting belief, write it down. Write it down. Confront it. When you realize you are writing an entire story in your head, that's one thing we naturally do before a meeting. We just naturally think of it going really badly. We just like, oh man, it's going to be like this. And he might say this, or she might get really mad at me, or they might say this or that or whatever. Learn to catch yourself writing those stories and say, okay, that may be the scenario, but what are some other scenarios that are possible? When we get upset about a look on someone's face, or they said something that could be taken two or three different ways, start to ask yourself, okay, what our natural tendency, unfortunately, is to think the worst. We want to be prepared for the worst case scenario because we want to survive. That's our ancient brain, our tribal brain thinking for us. So learn to ask yourself, what are some other ways, more resourceful ways to interpret what's going on? And if you have difficulty with that, confront, go back and say, okay, I feel like when you said this, I was concerned that it meant that you didn't approve of this, or that my job is on the line, or maybe I'm not going to get the promotion or something. I don't want to assume things without communicating. So can we talk about this? Can you elaborate or clarify? Learning to do that, that's a whole book. That's a whole talk. That's a whole training thing. But you can do that. Another thing that I always recommend, and I know a lot of people recommend it, journaling or talking through. One thing I do when I don't feel like journaling, sitting down and writing or typing, mm-hmm. is I'll imagine a committee in my mind and just have this conversation of different people in my mind. And they can be role models. They can be fictional or real role models, but put them in your mind and say, okay, I'm really bothered by this. What do you think about this? And just imagine what that role model would say. Bring in a committee of role models. No one has to know you're doing this, right? You don't have to talk to yourself in the bathroom or something like that, but just kind of imagine that. Bring in that committee of role models and say, and ask them, what should I be feeling about this?
Got it.
Yeah.
But overall, I continue to learn about the human nature. Are we people that we could continue to grow? Meaning, say, obviously, there is always certain issues that a person has that is unfixable. But on average, if we put our tendency to fix anything, our limiting beliefs, our personal growth, our skills, based on your research, for people listening to this, if they have any limitations in what they could achieve, should they stick to it, or is there something they could do to overcome it?
Oh, there's so much you can do to overcome it. So much to do. One thing that I've noticed that business leaders hide behind, and HR managers do this a lot, and I can't blame them, is that we have, over the last several decades, we've taken the human out of human resources, and we've replaced it with data and metrics and studies and personality profiles. And the danger of that is I've had people say, oh, well, that's me. I'm a sanguine, you know, or I'm a D. Or I'm an I.
I'm a circle. I'm a bottom square.
Right. Exactly. That's just who I am. And that's their story that they can live in. And it's like, it's a cop-out. It's something they can hide behind. It takes courage to be vulnerable. You know, it's so much easier to look at how other people can change and how other people can grow. And of course, we never need to grow, right? Yeah. So I am blessed. I am fortunate to have a natural tendency to always want to be better. I know where that comes from. And it goes back to that event I alluded to when I was 2 years old, and I made a decision at 2 years old, okay, I always need to make my parents proud of me. And that has manifested into overachieving in some cases, but it always made me want to be the best person that I could possibly be. Not everyone has that. A lot of people are programmed by parents. It's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And when we're programmed to think that's just the way it is, that's all we see. I would say, so really the first step is to start to think about what your model of the world is in different situations and think, what's above the castle wall? You know, you've built this castle wall of beliefs around you. What's above it? What if there's a window in the castle wall and I look at a whole other reality? There's a meme, a cartoon, and I'm trying to find the artist so I can get permission to put it in the book I'm writing. But it's brilliant because he shows two prisoners behind bars and they're both painting. And one person paints the beautiful scenery outside of the bars, and the other person only paints the bars. And that, to me, that's my favorite cartoon ever drawn, because it really does exemplify how we can limit ourselves or we see the better possibilities.
Yeah, both see the same thing. The question is, how do you interpret it? You see.
Exactly.
Beautiful. How can people find out more about your programs, your speaking, and just following you in general?
They can go to keithhadrill.com. So that's KEITHHADDRILL. If they want to learn more about my book, which is all about being, it's called Diametrically Connected. I'm still writing it, but you can get on the list. You can, in fact, I invite people to go on and tell me what they want to see in the book, what they want or need to learn in the book. And you can literally go to learnabouttthebook.com.
Oh, wow.
You get to that page. I also got the book everyoneshouldread.com. I'm really proud of that. Yeah. So connect with me through there and I'd love to hear from you.
Sure. So the links, resources mentioned this episode, check out the show notes at www.ptexgroup.com/podcast. We will link up to the website just mentioned so you can learn more about the book and also about the programs our guest today speaks about. Let's close with the four rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Number one, a book that changed your life.
A book that changed my life. I would say it's a movie and it was Pirates of the Caribbean. And yeah, I guess I can't elaborate. It's supposed to be rapid fire, right?
Okay. Number two, a piece of advice you got that you never forget.
How can I serve others as opposed to how can they serve me?
Beautiful. Number three, anything you wish you could go back and do differently?
Any one thing?
What comes to mind?
I would have gotten into NLP in my young 20s, much earlier.
And last and final question, what's still in your bucket list to achieve?
I want my book to change lives. I want my book to change millions of lives. It's how I want to serve our very divided nation.
Beautiful. Keith, thank you so much for joining us. I know your time is valuable. That is why, in the name of our listeners, we'll forever be grateful for sharing some of your time with us today. Been a blast.
Right. Thank you so much for having me. I've had a blast.
My pleasure. That's my conversation with Keith Hadrill. My takeaway from this one, number one, only 7% of communication is the words you use. The rest, 93%, takes place through nonverbal personal interaction. When your workforce doesn't come to the office, the possibility of miscommunication is overwhelming. Keep that in mind when deciding how much you want your employees to work remotely. Number two, each of us creates our own map of reality or our own model of the world. And a big part of connecting with other people is finding where your maps or models overlap. Ask questions of the people around you so that you can discover the points where your visions intersect. And from there on, communicating will be much easier and more effective. Number three, on the other hand, if we only look at our own models of the world, we'll never move beyond our perceived notions of how things work and how people act. This will hamper communication just as much as seeing other people's models will help it. Number four, when you feel stuck by a self-limiting belief, write it down on an index card. That way, you can confront it properly, recognize that you're writing a story, and most importantly, realize that there may be different and better endings than the endings you've already envisioned.
That's a wrap on another episode of Let's Talk Business, the podcast for no-nonsense advice to help you grow and lead. Subscribe to the Let's Talk Business show on your favorite podcast app or on our website at www.ptexgroup.com/podcast. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. Do you know other entrepreneurs who want to turn their ambition into action and passion into profits? Sharing is caring. Tell them about the show. The Let's Talk Business show is a production of PTEX Group. For more information, visit www.ptexgroup.com.